Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show, Danielle.
Thank you, Jim.
Danielle, are companies still buying back their own stocks at a crazy rate anymore?
Well, if we start with the bigger picture,
yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
The credit conditions have contracted in the last year at an extremely rapid rate. I think it's hard to actually appreciate how fast it's happened and how severe. And that greatly impacts the ability of companies to do all sorts of things, buybacks being one of them. Because despite this notion that people were thinking that companies recycle free cash into buybacks, they do some of that, but a lot of the buybacks that were happening were with borrowed money. And as you know, for the last 12 or 13 years, we had all sorts of monetary experiments that kept rates unnaturally low, near zero, and that it was the catalyst for all sorts of destructive things, throwing capital around like drunken sailors, you know, tossing it at speculation of various kinds. And one of the most heinous examples of that being companies buying back their shares so their executives could sell their, you know, part of their compensation awards into the flow. That's literally what they were doing. They were, you know, using the company buybacks to provide price pressure for their own exits. So that was very lucrative for executive compensation, but very negative for intelligent allocation decisions. And the reason, too, is that we know that there's a credit cycle, that you always come to the peak of revenue when the economy is sort of fully maxed out on what it can borrow and spend. And then you get into the downturn where everything mean reverts and cash becomes king. And the productivity investments that the companies made in the prior boom are the things that really see them through or not, right? So to the extent to which they automated or made processes highly efficient, increased their productivity, trained their workforce, you know, figured out ways to run smart and lean, those are the things that really help when the revenue downturn comes. And the opposite is also true, right? If you borrow your brains out during the expansion and do non-productive things, like buying financial assets and gimmicks, then what happens is you come into the downturn and, of course, you're flat-footed. So that's really what we're seeing across the board right now. And it's evident in every sector. Every day we're getting more layoff announcements from, you know, large corporations, which is going to eventually lead to a higher unemployment rate. That's a lagging indicator. But we can see that, you know, all sorts of measurements of the workforce are weakening in here. That will be one of the factors that helps to bring inflation down. You know, they were concerned about wage pressure and being a runaway inflationary spiral. That's fully in the rearview mirror now, and we're seeing, in fact, the inflationary inputs are all coming off the boil. So that's positive, but it's leaving behind all sorts of carnage because of the madness that was, right? So central banks are now watching things blow up and trying to run to the rescue with various bailout plans or, you know, backstops, new credit facilities, all these ideas. But there's very little discussion or acknowledgement that it was their, you know, more than a decade of reckless policies that really set everyone up for this big head fake. And, you know, I was on the CBC business panel last weekend, and I made the comment that that central banks have hiked at the fastest rate of change in decades, and possibly ever. And one of the readers took exception to that, and I've heard this similar comment from some people who will say, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, I remember in the 1970s and 80s, interest rates went to 17.9%, and today they're nowhere near that. And that misses the point entirely, because it's the rate of change. It's the base at which you start. So the overnight rate, which is essentially a wholesale funding rate in the banking system, has gone up 20-fold in 1 year. So this is the kind of unprecedented move. You know, when interest rates moved from 12% to 17%, that wasn't even a double. That was a 60% increase back then. And the principal portion was much lower than it is today. So that's the factors. You know, I think unless you owe money, perhaps in a floating rate environment right now, you may not be aware, but the average line of credit, like just a prime plus 4.5% kind of base line of credit, which is for the banks give or offer to their best customers, those current rates are above 11%. So this is something that we've not seen in, you know, 15 years or more. And HELOC loans, you know, those are also floating rate. A lot of people, very popular during the past few years as the housing market was going up and everyone was, you know, crazy about liquidity and flexibility of taking money out of your home and all this stuff to spend. Those HELOC rates are around 7% now. Variable rate mortgages are over 5.5%. And these are the things that were like 1.5% a year ago. So this, again, is what I'm talking about. This tripling and quadrupling of credit is really a massive shift. That is, and we know historically, I was writing about this for our month-end letter that goes out tomorrow to our clients, but historically, we know that the second year of the tightening cycle is when all hell breaks loose in the economy. And that's for the reasons that I've been outlining where, you know, not everyone has floating rate debt. A lot of people have fixed terms. A lot of corporations have fixed term debt. There was a survey done recently that showed that of the S&P 500 companies, the average weighted debt interest rate right now is 2.65. Well, there's billions and billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars that are up for renewal this year. And the rates that they're facing to replace that 2.65 is more like triple that amount. So you can see that this really can come on, you know, how do you go bankrupt slowly and then all of a sudden? This is the kind of environment that I'm talking about. And we shouldn't be surprised that we're seeing all these, you know, sort of cataclysmic events in some of the regional banks in the United States and some of the highly levered banks internationally, because it's really all connected to this shock coming into it unprepared and flat-footed, spending your brains out in the decade before, not planning for a rainy day, not building up cash, instead piling on debt, piling into asset bubbles, and then you get this wild rate of change where everything starts to fall and the dominoes really pick up momentum to the downside.
How would you describe the causes of inflation right now? Was it bad monetary policy on the part of central banks? Or is this now a supply chain problem? Because Tim Wood did a study looking at the M2, the availability of immediate money to companies and people. And he said that money supply has been falling since November. So he feels it's more of a supply chain inflation than one caused by an oversupply of money. What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's both. So yeah. I think that the original catalysts were, of course, the massive fiscal spending. You know, we saw the federal budget come out this week in Canada and announce that they're going to have a larger deficit going forward than anticipated. Well, the massive deficits that came during the pandemic in most developed countries, that was a huge part of the cash that flowed into the coffers of governments, of companies and households. So that was spending that was unleashed into the economy all of a sudden. At the same time, the central banks cut rates to zero again on top of, you know, they'd already done that for so long and been buying mortgage-backed securities and helping to funnel cash into the housing sector, which created all these bubbles in investment in not just residential, but commercial real estate, private equity, venture capital, all this money, trillions and trillions of dollars that was funneled into the banking system through the different, quantitative easing programs and all the different bank facility programs that were rolled out in the decade coming into the pandemic. So that was the backdrop. We already had a lot of bubbles. We already had a lot of debt. Then you get this, you know, again, reflex, cutting everything to zero, and then pumping more quantitative easing into the banking sector all the way through, even when governments responded with these massive fiscal bailouts for everyone in the economy, free money across the board. So it's very interesting. It is really all connected, Jim. So you get this boom in demand, which is funded by temporary funds, which are now run out. Okay, so being drawn down in the banking sector. And now we're seeing that people are realizing, hey, my company's not making the kind of revenue that it was before. I need to start drawing down some of this liquidity that I'd, piled in bank accounts when rates were making nothing, right? So no one had a cent incentive to really worry about, whether money was in a bank account when it was making zero everywhere and rates were zero everywhere and even long-term bonds were paying, less than 1%. So there was a very flat rate system, in the pandemic. And so people were kind of complacent, right? Lots of people that only, young people that haven't had bank account for more than 10 years have never seen interest being paid. So there's just a complacency that comes over the whole thing. And then what happens is, again, central banks start suddenly hiking rates, and it takes a while for the population to realize that, holy cow, I'm getting nothing. I think the average bank rate was 0.3% in the latest studies, by bank rate. So 0.3%, hey, I can get 4.5% to 5% if I go into, a government T-bill, which has very comparable risk. It's a cash-like equivalent. Or if I go into even some of the high-interest savings accounts, the banks, and GICs, these things offered suddenly at rates that people hadn't seen in 15 years. Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say, suddenly, hey, I'm going to move some of that money. And that's what started happening. Of course, it starts slow and then it builds and news gets out, word spreads, and all of a sudden everyone's on their phone moving their money. And then you get this drop, a huge drop, the largest outflow of the banking system actually on record. Almost $600 billion have left U.S. bank accounts just over the past year, and half of that in the month of March. So this is what I mean. It really catches up all of a sudden. So banks are like now, losing deposits. The regional banks, the weaker banks, the ones that don't have these high interest savings products to offer to their customers are really in a bad way because they have nothing to compete. They can suddenly increase the rates they're offering on their bank accounts, which they're starting to do, but don't forget that is a huge, deposits are the cheapest source of funding for banks. So if they suddenly start paying a lot more, that really crushes their profit margins, their spread. And those regional or smaller banks don't have these high interest savings products to offer people. So those funds just flow right out, at least with the larger banks. They, first of all, came into this mess more regulated by force, not by choice. They fought it every step of the way. But because the Great Financial Crisis revealed how much lunacy was going on in the large banks, they were higher capital requirements coming into this debauchery. And then at the same time, they do have these other products where they can offer, higher interest rates to retain capital. So they lose spread on that. When money moves from a bank account to a high interest savings account, they don't have nearly the profit, but at least it still counts as money available for loans. So they don't lose the liquidity out the door like some of these other institutions are. And that's why all of a sudden you've seen this big shock of, Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, there's First Republic, all these U.S. banks that went into this, again, not very well risk managed, not appropriately hedged because everyone was complacent in a decade of low rates. And they became, very foolish with their choices, as were the depositors not paying attention because, they forgot that there was risk in how you allocate capital in the banking system. So all of that said, those are the factors, that artificial flowing of capital from governments and central banks, the obsessive compulsive spending by households who are anxious from the pandemic, companies taking that free money and piling it into their things like their shares and other assets like real estate, all of that was the things that really drove up the price. Now, what you get on the other way down, of course, is the opposite effect. So profits were really inflated on the excuse of inflation. They used that as an opportunity to increase their prices significantly. And, of course, now when we get to the downside of that, where the cost of things have come down, for example, the commodities index, the CRB index, is off significantly, like more than 30% just from its peak. And so those are input costs. You know, the cost of oil was bouncing around 70 the last little while. And, you know, even an ongoing war in Ukraine, you still can't get the price of oil to go up. It's down significantly from its peak. And the reason is because we've got this demand crashing all over the world, inventories rising, you know, Chinese exports in the toilet. I mean, all these things are indicative of the drying up of capital portion of this credit cycle, which is finding so many people unprepared.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, how reliable or solid are Canadian banks? And should Canadians have a higher depositor insurance rate or guarantee? It's $100,000 right now, or about $73,000 American. In the U.S., it's $250,000.
Yeah, so it should be higher. It's been stuck at $100,000 for many years now, and part of that again is back to banks not wanting to pay more for higher insurance premiums into the CDIC fund. So they've been balking at the idea of increasing that coverage. But the overall takeaway I think from the problem with the Silicon Valley Bank was that the government then stepped in to quell the fears and said, don't worry, we're going to backstop 100% of the deposits. Now, you know, Janet Yellen and Treasury officials have tried to backpedal since then and saying, well, we didn't mean we were going to backstop all the deposits in all the banks. But that is certainly the precedent that is suggested by this. And I think I've long thought that if we got into another financial crisis in the banking system in Canada, that you would see pressure on the federal government to say that they would backstop the CDIC to protect depositors. Now, the important thing to appreciate here is they don't do anything to protect stock and bondholders in this scenario, right? Those are the people that actually were taking their losses on those failed banks this month in America. And that's actually how it's supposed to be. That's why it matters where you put your capital and what kind of concentration exposure you have and what valuations you pay for things. And all of that really matters in terms of the risk exposure of an investment portfolio. So there's really two distinct things there. Cash that's purely cash on deposit, and that includes things like the bank accounts, the GICs, the high interest savings accounts, those all fall under the CIDC. And then in addition to that, most investment brokers that in Canada pay into the Investor Protection Fund as well, which is $1 million of insurance per account. So for the regular person, the small person, the person that doesn't have a lot of money, those coverages are pretty significant. It's for the people that have amassed really, a greater amount of their life savings at this point that it gets quite concerning how best to protect it. But at this point, as I say, my concern is not with respect to the strength or stability or the solvency of our banks in Canada. My concern is about the asset side of so many people, whether it's retirement portfolios, whether it's the housing sector, the real estate sector, the office sector, all these places, the commercial real estate part, which has been so overbuilt by all the free money that was flowing, all the speculative behaviors. And now we're seeing, of course, the amount of vacancies falling, like 20% vacancy rates in many cities. So there's a lot of investments, real estate investment trusts, banking investments that have been made by pensions, institutions, individuals, funds that are in this space And the solution so far by the ones who are coming under pressure, because again, cash has been flying out, as I said, for reasons of needing cash because the economy is producing less free cash flow, but also for a revelation that, oh, my cost of carry has gone up significantly. I'd like to pay off some of this debt to lower my costs. Oh, I'm going to cash out some money here to move it over. Now the incentives in the economy have completely shifted from when rates, money was worth nothing, cash is trash, that whole madness. People were obsessed with getting it into things and getting debt on because debt was so cheap. Now the tide has really shifted and the obsession is, how do I get out of debt? How do I get it paid off? Oh my God, my line of credit has doubled in the last year. I don't want that. This sort of thing. So people are now looking to pull money back out of these places where they'd put it. And that is driving this liquidity crunch. So you've got things like, the solution in many, some of these funds to date, and we're talking some very established big ones, is just put gates down and say people aren't allowed to take their cash back out. Well, that's a solution you can only do for so long, and historically that always builds an even greater panic to get out of things when the gates are down for 3 or 4 months and then they finally say you'll be able to redeem on certain such and such a date. You see a massive exodus of capital at the moment that the gates are lifted. And what you're starting to see now is extensions of those gates being down, so people are not being given back their money. That just makes this whole pent-up selling pressure even more extreme. Or some of the companies are just handing the keys back to the lenders, just saying, well, we can't possibly refinance this. Our rate was 2.6 and now we're facing 9.5. The math barely worked at 2.6 because the valuations were too high. And now our vacancy rates are coming off significantly. So there's no way we can make this work. Here's your keys back. That's the last thing the lenders want, right? The lenders are not in the business of managing real estate. They're in the business of just taking interest on loans. So we saw this same sort of debacle in the subprime crisis in 2006 in the United States. What's very interesting to me, we also saw this kind of dynamic in the savings and loan debacle, which was sort of 1988 through 1993. I don't know if you remember any of that, Jim, but that was also a situation where there was a very high percentage of commercial real estate loans, mortgage-backed securities, on the bank's balance sheets, especially of some of these smaller, more regional, less regulated entities. And what had preceded that was, again, a boondoggle in the real estate sector where people were just throwing money around into everything, not concerned about, historical patterns or the yield to income or rents or any of that. Just get it in. It was a speculative madness. That precluded the blow up that finally came when prices started to go down and credit, the cost of credit went up significantly. Nothing like it's gone up so far, but a fraction of what it did then was enough to topple the whole thing. And then you had 5 years of, strife and trying to sell off assets and lower prices and people going bankrupt, companies going bankrupt. That was the whole thing that happened back then. And there's a lot of similarities to that today. The other thing is, I got a kick out of, you see banks, financial markets rallying in the last couple of days on this relief or feeling of, oh good, well, Credit Suisse got bought by UBS and the government backstop deposits at those other banks and surely that's the end of it and all is well. It reminds me so much of the Bear Stearns blow up that happened, if you recall. The timeline to that is, it was 6 months between the Bear Stearns blow up, which basically, they had to freeze redemptions from their mortgage-backed securities, highly levered real estate loans, in about June of 07. Then in March of January of 2008, Moody's downgraded them, which is exactly what happened with the banking sector. Last week in the United States, Moody's has got them on watch for a whole downgrade of the entire sector, and then that means it's more expensive when a company and sector is downgraded for them to float more shares or sell more bonds or shares to the public because there's now fear about their credit quality. So it's typically a terrible time to try and raise capital. told they can't do it, and all of a sudden they're in a insolvency crisis. So that's when J.P. Morgan was tapped to take over Bear Stearns in March of 2008. And then you had a big rally in the stock market, right? But that wasn't nearly the bottom, because it went on to fall another 30% between October of 2008 and March of 2009. And it was 6 months after the Bear Stearns fiasco that, in September of 2008, that the Lehman Brothers Bank collapsed. And that was when we started to know it was a major financial crisis. So I just think, you know, we have to be aware that the stock markets basically have gone nowhere for 2 years. The TSX itself, you know, is back now to where it was 20 months ago, the S&P 25 months ago, and the NASDAQ's at the same level it was 27 months ago in December of 2020. So this crisis is all connected and has been moving for a long time. Within it, there's been a lot of volatility, a lot of ups and downs in terms of, you know, day-to-day rallies and then breaking down to a lower low. But ultimately, nothing has been fixed here. So it is not a time for people to go back to sleep and think that all is well. You know, the economically sensitive parts of the economy are in a downdraft. We just entered year two of the tightening cycle. The Fed says it may tighten further, but even if it doesn't, I think you're going to find that the rate of change here on the downturn is going to be shocking to a lot of people. And then we've got all this debt coming up for renewal at these much higher rates. So the good news is that the safest credits in the market, the treasury bonds, have been rallying, which means the yields have been falling, which means fixed mortgage rates have not been rising for a few months, and eventually will probably start to come back down. But the bad part of it is that'll be too little too late for a lot of people, because they, as I said, came into this completely ill-prepared.
Danielle, if commercial real estate's in trouble and Canada has a housing crisis, how viable would it be for maybe government support to turn some of that commercial property into a place to live?
Well, there's going to be a lot of empty properties. We know that, relatively speaking, because we overbuilt, because we're in the midst of secular shifts in behavior, hybrid work models, automation, all these things that mean you need less workforce, and they're more dispersed. They're not necessarily in these highly urbanized areas anymore. But I'm actually heartened that there's all sorts of smart things we can do. You know, for example, with respect to harvesting energy, we can turn them into power plants. We can turn them into battery storage places. There's a lot of things we can do that will actually help our efficiency. It's not like they have to be completely wasted structures. And yes, we can make more affordable housing for people, probably in the rental side. If you look at the dynamics of the math, I was just reviewing this for many cities across the country, and nearly every one of them, actually, I think in every one of them, the dynamics of renting was far more affordable. Even though rents have gone up and rents have been high, they're starting to come off, and they've been scarce. There hasn't been enough supply. But the prospect of renting is a much more affordable, like by $1,000 a month and more, cheaper than trying to buy the same kind of property or same kind of home, given where mortgage rates and principal, the principal portion being so high today. So it makes sense to, you know, invest in more modest rental accommodation where people can afford to live, save money, and, you know, build the strength again for the future, rather than reaching and trying to maintain assets for show that they can't actually afford. So I think there's a lot of sober and humility and things that have to be rethought. But ultimately, we have a lot to gain in terms of productivity enhancement here. And that, I think, is a good thing.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on howstreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.